former president returns to the natural state with calls for hope and unity. More on that, plus we take a look at state officials' efforts to regulate and take advantage of artificial intelligence. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. Green, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. Former President Barack Obama was in the natural state this week as part of a new lecture series at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. We get a recap from KUAF's Kyle Kellums.
Well, I love you back. It's good to see you. But you didn't tell me it gets this cold in Arkansas.
President Obama came onto the stage to a standing ovation. The 70-minute conversation, moderated by Olivia Walton, chair of the Crystal Bridges Board, took place inside the new Whole Health Institute on the Crystal Bridges campus. The discussion covered democracy, President Obama's time in the White House, and his thoughts about the future. Walton asked the president about a passage in his first memoir. He's currently working on his second volume, describing his unshakable pride in being American. She asked how he felt about those words now, when the concept of patriotism can seem politicized. The former president credits much of his deep respect for the country's ideals back to the times he spent living abroad as a child.
What I always understood was that for all our flaws, the idea of America was powerful. And it was the reason why I was a magnet for people from other parts of the world to come here. And I think the reason patriotism got politicized is that both the left and the right sometimes got confused in thinking that it was not possible to take an honest look at America's flaws and be critical of it and still love it. And that's a mistake, right? It is a great expression of love for this country to say that we have not always been perfect. And the reason we have kept getting better is because we had a bunch of people who said, this isn't as good as we can be. But the ideals were there. That was the North Star that pointed us in that direction. And that's the exceptionalism of America. There have been empires of every sort on every continent that have had the biggest armies or had the most money or, built the biggest monuments. And it's bounced around from Egypt to Greece to China. That's not unique to America. Their empires have risen and fallen. You know what's been pretty unique is this idea that you get a bunch of people from every corner of the planet who don't look alike, don't worship exactly the same way to their God, and don't eat the same foods, don't have the same last names, but somehow they're all working together and they can figure out how to make this place their own and live together and create something that hasn't been there before.
Walton asked if, in 2025, he thinks current national division presents a more divided than ever nation, and if a wide separation could be a serious challenge to achieve the American ideals he discussed, or if even a widely divided population could be a challenge for democracy.
I think it is true that we are more divided and that our democracy is more unstable than any time in my lifetime, not in American history. I mean, you know, we did have like a civil war and stuff. I mean, there've been some pretty big, you know, breakdowns in the process. But I would say that the order, the system, the sets of institutions that were built after World War II and then refined over the course of subsequent generations, I think those are unstable in ways I would not have expected. I would not have expected the legitimacy of an election and the peaceful transfer of power to have been challenged. I thought that was not something that would happen today. I would not expect the politicization of the Justice Department or our military. And I don't think that's happened. I think there's been resistance, particularly in the military, to that. But the degree to which that has been encouraged, you know, that used to be something that I would lecture other countries not to do. You don't have your military involved in partisan politics. Its loyalty is to the Constitution. Its loyalty is not to any party. Its loyalty is not to any party, and it is not to any president. When I came into office, my working assumption was that I did not win the Pentagon vote. I'm running against John McCain, a war hero and POW, and I am a 47-year-old African-American from Chicago who had never served. And when I was sworn into office and I boarded Marine One or Air Force One, they saluted. And if I said, this is what we need to do, they said, yes, sir. And when I'm sitting with my Joint Chiefs of Staff, they are giving me their best unvarnished advice. And over time, I didn't just win them following orders. They would say, because they've written about it, I won their respect because they never saw me make a decision about national security that in any way was affected by me worrying about my politics. Because they also understood we were in the middle of two wars, and the most sacred duty I had was if I was going to send some 22-year-old kid on the other side of the world and potentially would die, I could not look myself in the mirror if I was making those decisions based on politics.
Monday's conversation was balanced between past, present, and future. President Obama says his life at 1700 Pennsylvania Avenue could be amazing when musical acts rehearse for a next-day White House performance, but could also be confining and tiring. He says a particularly poignant memory, a goosebumps moment, is the night the Affordable Care Act passed.
Yeah, the votes got tallied. It had been this, you know, incredible process. And It had looked like we had fallen short probably 5-6 different times. It had been declared dead, and finally we were all in the cabinet room watching the votes go up, and when that last vote comes, like everybody had worked on it, clapped and hugged, and it turned out Michelle and the girls were out somewhere. They were traveling, so I had the house to myself. So typical bachelor type, you know, hey, everybody, why don't you come on up to our place?
In the White House.
In the White House. Yeah. Up the residence. And so you've got all these young people. And the thing I think people don't fully appreciate is you have the president, you have the cabinet, and typically folks in there, say, between 40 and 65. But you have all these 25 and 35-year-olds who are just grinding. I mean, they're not getting paid any money, and they're just working tirelessly and brilliantly and navigating all the details of the process and, you know, answering questions for folks. And so they're putting all their hearts into it. And I, to have them all there, and then I said to them, and I meant this, I said, this moment right here is more satisfying. It means more to me than the day I got elected. Because the point of getting elected was to do this.
To close the conversation, Olivia Walton asked the former president about a word often attributed to his campaign, his 2 terms in Washington, and his life after the White House. Hope. What, she asked, informs his hope for the future now?
Young people I meet give me hope. The energy they've got, the insights, the sophistication, their natural instincts towards including people and being interested in people, even if they're not exactly like them. I think they're less parochial than we were. And the thing I try to just communicate to them is they too should be hopeful, because the only thing I worry about this upcoming generation is partly because of their phones. They are bombarded with a lot of bad news all the time. I mean, there's a sensory overload coming at them in ways that we just didn't experience. Right? And it starts at an early age. And part of what I try to emphasize to them is, yes, there are a lot of big problems today, but there really have always been a lot of big problems. In fact, I mentioned it earlier. If you looked at the course of human history and you asked yourself, you didn't know who you were ahead of time. You didn't know whether you were an Obama or a Walton or a Rodriguez or a, you know, Chen, what country you were living. If you just said, behind the veil, when would you want to exist as a human, not knowing where you occupy, what station you occupy, you'd choose right now with all the problems. The odds would be more likely that you had enough to eat, that you could read, that if you got pneumonia, you wouldn't die, that, you know, you'd have a roof over your head and you could raise a family and support them and live a long, healthy life. The odds are higher today than ever. I said, so, yeah, we got some issues, but we've always had issues. You know, and this goes back to the patriotism thing. there are times where I hear people say things like, you know, race relations are worse than they've ever been. Well, that can't be true. That can't be true. That is, nah. That's not right. That's not true. Like, oh, there, you know, there's a, this, you know, we're going back to, you know, it's like Handmaid's Tale. Well, no, it's not that. You know, yeah, men can still be sometimes stupid, but they love their daughters, and I think we're past the point where systematically we're going to deprive women of their rights. So I am hopeful as long as young people don't succumb to cynicism or despair.
President Barack Obama Monday in Bentonville, speaking with Olivia Walton, the board chair of Crystal Bridges, as the first guest in the museum's Building Bridges series.
That was KUAF's Kyle Kellums reporting. We're living in a new world when it comes to the rise in artificial intelligence. Along with technological advancements, inherently comes new questions and concerns. KASU's Marty Scarborough spoke with Republican State Senator Bart Hester, who leads the newly formed Heartland AI Caucus, about their concerns and their work to alleviate and address them.
Well, it won't just be legislators. There will be, you know, the smart people from the industry as well, people that it's going to affect their lives, people that are using it. Look, us as legislators, you know, I have a particular ability, hopefully, to facilitate and lead a group and then hopefully lead the group into policy that's passable in our state legislatures. I think the Heartland is poised to lead in certain issues like tech because we know we can move faster than the federal government. We're pretty confident we know we can move faster than the West and the East Coast. I think we have a chance to show the country and the world that the Heartland is the wave of the future.
From your perspective, what are some of the definitions of exactly from your caucus's perspective as to what AI is?
Well, we're not meeting yet. But look, I think anybody that calls themselves an AI expert today may not be an expert tomorrow. It's moving really fast. And basically the importance of this is, that, you know, it's artificial learning and computers do thinking for us. And what does that mean? And anytime there's some new technology like this, there's people that want to use it for bad things. I think our real focus is going to be on how do we create, you know, a 10-lane interstate that allows industry to work on fair playing rules. You know, I don't want to have a one-lane bridge, but there's got to be some guardrails that protect the general public and creators.
Well, what are some ways in which you can see AI driving economic growth, particularly in the Heartland?
I mean, one of the things I'm really interested about with this is we've seen in so many rural parts of Arkansas and parts of rural parts of the Heartland is when the one industry or one of the two industries leave town just shrivels up. Well, I think what's interesting about AI is people can work from home. So if they love their small town life and community, I mean, I think if people get a little taste of it, they want it. But you also got to have a job. People can use AI, work for other companies, create their own companies from the comforts of their rural living.
Well, that's one of the big concerns that people have about AI is that it will be displacing some people out of jobs. How do you see your caucus helping to promote ways in which people can learn how to best utilize AI within their current profession?
Man, I think you've nailed it. The word is education. Like we've got to educate people so they're not scared of it. Look, it's easy for me to get scared of AI, right? What's it going to do with the unknown? But anytime you're uneducated on an issue, you're fearful of it, or many, many times we are. But we've also got to educate people on what a great tool it could be. Look, there was a time when people said, I'll never use the internet. It's terrible. It's going to take our jobs or take this or spreadsheets when that came out. There'll be no more accountants. Well, look, it just means we're doing jobs differently and more efficient and faster. And I believe that's what AI is going to be. I think that's why it's so important that we create a fair playing field, and not just for the state of Arkansas, but all of the Heartland that can be used, model policy across state lines.
So let's talk about what can some of the things that state legislatures do to encourage use of AI to benefit people economically.
I like that. I'm going to actually kind of rephrase it. I think one of the things state legislators do too often is we discourage something, right? We put too much regulation on it. We hamper it and hinder it. We don't want to do that. We want to make fair playing rules where people that are the creators are comfortable using it, but not be too restrictive at all that we push back on the creator, people that are creative. You know, you said early on in this content or this interview that, there's a chance that our computers or AI start doing their creativity for us. I don't think you can ever out-creative the human element, the human mind, but it will do a lot of the preliminary work for people.
Well, one of the things that AI does, though, when you ask it to create something, is it looks across the internet to see what's already been created and then makes an amalgam of all of those things. Now, some people are saying that, well, if AI creates something new, but it learned about it from something that I did, the original creator should in some way be compensated for what the AI has done. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I will clarify, I'm not an AI expert at all. I think I'm an expert in state legislators. I'm an expert in facilitating, but I do have a thought. Look, at some point, my sixth grade English teacher could say that her helping me with math, should she get some of the money if I do something great, right? At some point, there's just known information that we all learn from. And I think there will be something in here that we have to discuss. How tight does that get? How long has the information been out there? I'm sure there's already some sort of norms throughout the industry that we'll work on.
Well, I'm thinking, for example, let's say that someone decides, you know, I want to create a brand new song in the style of Johnny Cash, and AI does that. I'm profiting from that. But does the family, the heirs of Johnny Cash, deserve any kind of financial compensation for any money I may have made from AI creating specifically a song that sounds like him?
That's a very compelling argument. We will have industry leaders, experts on all these types of issues that will speak into that. And look, the goal is to have something that works across the entire heartland, to show that the heartland can lead on tech. I really feel like we can. I feel like we can put together a product that works really great in the heartland, then goes from the heartland to the East and West Coast rather than things happening on the East and West Coast and affecting us.
Well, something you made reference to earlier is that, you know, there's a balance between legislation that can be beneficial or burdensome. How do you determine if something that's going to be proposed falls into either one of those categories?
Man, this is good. Like, I deal with this all the time. Like, the first question is there a compelling governmental interest? Is there a reason that the government should come in and regulate this at all? My general position on items is no. Stay out of the way, government. Let us go move forward. But I believe there is a compelling governmental interest to regulate this in some ways. Number one, we know protecting children, you know, protecting people's license creativity. There are some reasons that we should regulate it. So then if the answer is yes for me, then I move on to how do we do that in the least restrictive manner possible? So as the leader of this caucus, I will be focused on A, I agree we've got to have regulation. How do we do it in the least restrictive way possible?
That was Republican State Senator Bart Hester, chair of the Heartland AI Caucus. He spoke with KASU's Marty Scarborough. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.